This is I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. Appreciate you joining us for the show. I am Chris Ryan. While Pope Winanama, we are inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio as the holiday season is upon us. Giving Tuesday coming up on December the 1st. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, because obviously it's a really important thing for nonprofits in Riverbend, and we'll get into that in a sec. Also, Ken Norton's going to join us on the show today. Ken is the executive director for NAMI New Hampshire. He's going to talk about national suicide prevention, as well as the new number 988. And we talked a little bit about this last week, I believe, on the show, Paul, where there's going to be a number that you can dial if you are having a mental health crisis. And this is, again, just such a hugely important step in the right direction.
Yeah, just recently signed into law, I think, this summer, as far as getting to the whole thing put together. And bipartisan, of course, because, I mean, anyone who is against something like this really shouldn't be in office. But seriously, though, it's there's always been the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, an 800 number. Actually, if you ever need it, it's 800-273-8235. Make sure I'm reading that right. No, I'm sorry, 8255.
And that's the problem.
That's right the problem. Yeah, right. That's it's the such a long number. But now imagine 988 is, and I think they're talking, and we'll get more from Ken exactly what their timeline is, trying to have the whole thing put together, which has got to be a pretty monstrous task, like between the FCC and everything like that, by the summer of 2022.
Yeah, one of the first things that I really got involved with from a public policy perspective was with Peter Evers. And with some of our leaders at the state, Governor Haston at the time, Senator Feltes. And it was basically about this. But there's a lot of different aspects of having to build out something like this for a mental health or a substance misuse crisis. And in order for it to work, and this was a problem, if we tried to push forward basically a hotline for individuals who are having issues of substance misuse during the peak of the opioid epidemic around 2000 and, I think 14, 15, no, it was 2016. And, 2015. And so that was a discussion that was taking place. But having the hotline is one thing. Having the infrastructure in place to man the hotline and having the services available for to be on the back end is extremely important as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about that with Ken today. As anecdotally speaking, I've had a friend who is having a really difficult time, and his son has had mental health and overdose issues as a teenager. And he has been going through, the system trying to get the appropriate help for his son, and has been beyond frustrated with the capacity to do that. He is of means, and he has been unable to secure that help. And he has been unable to find something that works for his son, who's been struggling. And this is a story that is fairly common. We have addressed mental health in a substantive way, and we're doing the best we can, particularly during the course of a pandemic. But there are still children who are in hospitals across this state who are waiting to be seen for mental health. The beds aren't available currently. And there was a time when we were at surplus, but that's not that time anymore. And, it gets back to what we've talked about a lot, in that there has been tremendous progress made, but we have a long way to go. And, that will not be achieved until we have parity on physical and mental health. It should not be that difficult for individuals to be able to access and have mental health care that works for them and their families. And unfortunately, you know, this is, you know, very often the case.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing as far as treatment and beds and places for folks to go who are in need of a more I'm trying to think of the best word for it, basically a more one-on-one type long-term
exactly.
type treatment. You know, I mean, yeah, I can go to therapy, and you know, and that's and that helps me, and but there are some folks, and we've talked about this before. You know, it's like, okay, I have a virus, or I have the flu. That's one thing. I have cancer. That's another thing. Well, in mental health, there's issues in the same sense where okay, I'm dealing with anxiety, but it's anxiety that can be dealt with on an outpatient. Great, but I'm dealing with something like bipolar, or I'm dealing with a substance misuse disorder. Those are things that are more on the other end of the scale, and I think that especially the scary thing with this pandemic is they talk about people who are having symptoms of heart attacks and things like that, and they're like, well, no, I shouldn't go to the hospital because there's people with COVID there. Well, I can imagine that the exact same thing is going on with folks who are like, wow, what I'm feeling isn't right, and I need to do something about this, but I'm sure that they're really busy with other people.
Well, that's the panic attack / heart attack thing is a whole different story, because as a person that has panic attacks, I will generally not go to when I was younger, I would call up and they'd say, well, you need to go to the emergency room. But like, I'm not going to the emergency room.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have $3,000. Like, what is wrong with you?
Or not even just the financial aspect of it. It's the, oh, I don't want to put someone out because, you know, it's like, oh, no, I'll be fine.
I know. Well, I'll be fine. Right. So there's a whole bunch of different factors. A, the financial part is a big part, mm-hmm. particularly for somebody who is, you know, in their 20s and just trying to. So that's that. And that
working in this industry.
Right. When you are in your 20s working in this industry, you are working basically for slave wages.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I was at that point. And there's also, you don't want to put somebody out. You know what the problem is. It's more likely. So there's a really good chance that at some point in time in my life, a heart attack happens and I just think it's a panic attack. And that's a big concern of mine. And that's the way that a lot of people who have panic attacks on a continuous basis operate. Like, oh, it could be. Maybe this one feels a little bit different. And there'll be times where it has felt a little bit different. And then I go in. But you never quite know. So that's a different topic, but kind of along the same lines. In regards to the inpatient care, I think you make a number of good points. And in certain situations, the mental health capacity is there. And, you know, but in my view, and Riverbend has done a really good job of this. It's one of the reasons I love this organization so much, in that they're meeting people where they are. But, you know, there's a lot of times when a individual cannot just be, you know, seeing a clinician one day a week at, you know, 2 p.m. when they're in their worst circumstance at night. And, you know, by the time, you know, you get 2 o'clock rolls around, you've gotten through your depressive episode and et cetera. Now, there's resources that are available, and Riverbend again has done a great job of reaching out. But, you know, in a circumstance where you are in a suicidal state that you cannot shake, that is going on for days, mm-hmm. weeks, that is an inpatient type setting where, you know, and if not, it falls upon loved ones, if they're available, to consistently watch and try to help that person. And that can be more draining for the caregiver than just about any other health circumstance, because, you know, if you're caring for someone that is sick, then you're bringing them things, you're doing the best you can. If you're trying to talk somebody out of a suicidal state when you love them, and that is horrible, and it's not talked about, you know, nearly enough, and it happens, I think, on a pretty consistent basis, but it is something that remains behind closed doors. Nobody wants to talk about, particularly if an individual is successful, the type of mental health things that take place behind the scenes, because if it comes out, there's a concern about, well, what does that mean for your job? What does it mean for your ability to take care of your kids? What if this is something that is used against you moving forward? You know, physical health things usually don't get used against you
right.
moving forward.
Yep.
Mental health things, yeah. I mean, there's a real concern about putting those things out there. So, you know, this friend of mine reached out a week ago, and they have a, you know, they went on social media and started talking a little bit about it last night. And I think that it's a really important conversation, you know, to have and to continue to move forward on, particularly for, and I don't think we should discriminate based upon age, but, you know, particularly if it's, you know, a teenager or a child and they are, you know, suffering or in the throes of mental illness, have tried to commit suicide or either overtly or via substances. We have to do a better job as a state and as a society of meeting the needs of people. And, you know, very often the healthcare industry, you know, it's a business, you know, will meet the needs of individuals in a lot of other different ways. But we need to meet the needs of individuals when they are at their very bottom and when they need help the most. And it is inexcusable in a nation of our wealth, in a state of our wealth, although we are very frugal, that children are suffering in this way. I mean, there is very little things that are worse than having to deal with a child who is in the throes of mental illness.
Yeah, and I think, and I know what you're saying, you know, you don't want to discriminate age-wise, but one thing to take into the factor is that we're dealing with things like kids who haven't developed their brain to the capacity of fully. Executive function doesn't develop fully in a brain until age 21. So now you're dealing with someone who's dealing with a mental illness and just doesn't have the full capacity to deal with it. So yeah, the kids, I mean, there definitely has to be something in place for them, especially because they just don't have the full capability to stop and deal with it.
That is Paul Quidadamo. I am Chris Ryan. This is I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. Ken Norton joins us up next from NAMI. He's the executive director of NAMI New Hampshire, and he'll be with us after this on I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know that treatment works. This is I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. I am Chris Ryan, along with Paul Quidadamo. We're inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. We're going to be joined on the program right now by Ken Norton. He is the executive director for NAMI New Hampshire, and he joins us right now on the program. Ken, how are you?
Good. Good morning.
Good. Appreciate joining us for the show. So I want to kind of talk about what I was, you know, telling folks about in the open. And that is, you know, a good friend of mine has a teenage son who is really in the throes of a significant battle of mental illness at this point in time and substance misuse. And he is the dad at his wit's end. He is extremely frustrated with the lack of inpatient care to help his son. He's been trying to, you know, do something here for over a month at this point in getting his son the care that he needs. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what the capacity is right now for inpatient care. And, you know, why, in your view, as there has been, and you have done a lot of work on this, and many people have done a lot of great work on this, we've talked a lot about the strides that have been made in regards to elevating the conversation on mental illness and making substantive change at the state level. But a circumstance like this and the fact that inpatient care is so difficult to find at this point in time, and we know about children across the state who are waiting to get inpatient care, it's certainly been highlighted that there's still a long way to go in regards to making sure that people who need care receive that care. And to me, this story highlighted that.
Yeah, my heart goes out to that dad because I've experienced that challenge as well. And there just are not, we continue to be very siloed in our approach to mental health services as well as substance misuse and addiction. And so, and that said, I am as well. I can't really speak to the inpatient capacity or access on the substance abuse disorder side, but can speak and will speak more around the mental health piece. But we'll say that, that there's probably at least 50% overlap between the two, meaning that people have co-occurring disorders, people with serious mental illness, and that includes our young adults as well. And so that's a serious consideration. But yeah, the inpatient capacity side continues to be a significant challenge. Yesterday, there were 15 young adults and children waiting in emergency rooms for an inpatient bed, and 50 adults. So that's a total of 65 people in our state waiting for inpatient services.
So the question, though, is why? Why do we find ourselves in this area? Is there not the funding available? Is there not the professionals available? Why is it that mental health has this circumstance where if my son, God forbid, had an issue with, a heart condition or whatever, he would be able to get right in and would receive health care?
That is the question, and yeah, as you point out, Nami has said for years a major press conference that Riverbend played a lead role in back in 2013 that we held. Our opening was that it's wrong medically, legally, ethically, morally, and economically. And you're right. No other illness would somebody with a potentially life-threatening condition be held in an emergency room for days and days waiting for an inpatient bed. The answer is really complicated, although in some ways it could be said in a word, and that word would be long-standing discrimination against people with mental illness. It comes as a result of insurance companies and hospitals and providers not paying equal funding for those inpatient beds like they would for something else. So a lot of hospitals have decided it's not profitable and they've closed their inpatient units. There's not private hospitals like there used to be available with beds. But the bigger piece as well is the level of community supports that are needed to prevent people from needing a hospitalization. And they've been lacking, from where we were in the early 90s when we were rated number one in the country for mental health services, a point at which our founder, Peggy Straw, said when called by the press, great, we're the smartest kids in the dumb class. And it was said not without pride, but it was, if this is the best we can do in the country for people with mental illness, that's saying not much.
So how do we make a change, in your view? And that I think that everything you've said is right. To me, this is a time period within the COVID-19 environment where things are changing in the healthcare industry and where there's opportunity for things to change across the board. And to me, we have to demand that change, whether it's within a hospital setting and why they cannot have their own mental health care professionals so that they can provide that care there. I don't think that it's fair to ask because there are not entities like Riverbend in areas all across the country, and there's not that type of ability for them to build out their own infrastructure in order to have an inpatient setting. Hospitals, it would appear, would have the ability to have an inpatient setting, and individuals that were strictly focused upon mental health care, and in an optimal world, individuals that could do both, could provide physical health care and mental health care in either a outpatient or potentially an inpatient setting. So if you were able to wave your magic wand, if you will, what is the best way, and what is, in your view, the most practical way in order to address what is going to, in my view, continue to be a significant issue on the back end, which is the healthcare aspect in the community setting, but also in the most where the need is most consistently right now, and that is at the front end.
You've touched on a lot there, and a lot of really key points. And let me maybe work backwards and start with, you had mentioned COVID and to talk about the impact of COVID, because there's some irony here, but maybe that's not a strong enough word, that right now there are 65 people taking up emergency room beds in the state of New Hampshire, when we're in the midst of a COVID surge, that people may need those beds for. And that's a multifaceted problem. So not only are they just sitting in the emergency rooms waiting for inpatient admission, so they're getting minimal care, they're potentially exposed to COVID while they're in the emergency room, or they have higher risk for being impacted by COVID because they have co-occurring conditions, mental illness, and often other conditions, substance misuse, and they have the potential, because they're likely or they're headed toward admission to another facility, they have the likelihood of potentially carrying that into another setting, which could then create workforce shortages in that setting, as that workforce on an inpatient setting is potentially exposed to COVID and needing quarantine. We're already seeing some of that right now. So that's, that's one aspect of that. And, and another aspect is that we managed to clear out the hospitals and open up new units and having standby units back in the spring when COVID surge first hit. But somehow we've been unwilling to do that for this mental health crisis that has gone on for years and years and years. And it's harming people. When treatment delayed is treatment denied. We know that with mental illness, like any other illness, the sooner somebody is treated, the better they get. Not just the quicker they get better, but the better they get better, if that makes sense. So that's one piece of it. Another piece that you talked about is a more integrated system of care, which we've made great gains with in recent years in New Hampshire and elsewhere in the country. The recognition that having this segregated system of care hasn't served anyone, particularly people with mental illness, very well. And that was highlighted by a study by the National Institute of Health a few years ago that showed that people with serious mental illness died 25 years younger than their peers in the general population. And they noted that wasn't necessarily the impact of suicide. It was often co-occurring conditions like diabetes and heart disease, obesity due to medication side effects, smoking. But also noted that they just did not get good health care and have access to integrated health care in the same way that the general population did. So that's another key point. And then when we get to the magic wand part, for me, one of the things that we as NAMI have wanted to see now for years is statewide mobile crisis response. Certainly Riverbend was the first first area in the state to start that under the mental health lawsuit settlement agreement. It was required in the Concord area, and then Manchester, and then Nashua. But we still now are sitting here with only three areas in the state. There was legislation passed in 2014 to bring it statewide, but for a variety of reasons, implementation of that has been slowed down, and we're still without it. We know that when mobile crisis responds, that there's much less likelihood of somebody being admitted to the hospital. I mean, certainly they don't need to come to the hospital in most circumstances. And, you know, and that might pair well with what we've seen in terms of the federal legislation to introduce 988, so that people have another option when they're in a mental health crisis, families or individuals, other than going to the emergency room or calling 911.
Now, Ken, in regards to the 988, and I know that you've worked on this a lot, I mean, what's the setup going to be like once this is put into full effect? Are we talking call centers beyond what there is right now for national hotline, or is it more just an infrastructure set up to make it easier to get in touch with the hotline?
Yeah, that's really such an important question, and it's very involved, so bear with me. I'll try to keep it somewhat brief. But right now, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255, is primarily a volunteer service, and it's run by about 162, or the number fluctuates a bit, different crisis centers that are certified in the country. Ours in New Hampshire is Headrest in Lebanon. And they're largely volunteer efforts, and a lot of the fundraising happens locally. The federal government provides to most of these centers less than $4,000 or $5,000 a year in funding to operate a 24/7 crisis line. And by contrast, the Veterans Crisis Line, which is, you know, the press one option on that same 800-273-8255, is a professionally staffed with regional call centers around the country, a budget of somewhere over $100 million compared to, I think, the Lifeline budget of, $8 or $9 million by contrast. So I think one of the things that we all recognize is that as we move to 988, that it will change and likely no longer just be number one, there will be a dramatic increase in calls when we go to a three-digit number. And that those increase in calls will not necessarily just be suicide-related calls, but they'll be for any mental health crisis, as it should be. And so the conversations are, how do we prepare for those increase in call volumes? Can these regional volunteer-oriented organizations handle that increase? Capacity? Do they want to handle that increase in capacity? And how do we prepare for that? There is in the federal legislation, there is the ability to, as I understand it, to tax some of the telephone companies, or to tax via telephone bills to get people to pay a couple cents that would go into supporting this change. But for the moment, it will just be, that the federal government is working on the technology transfer so that that the three-digit number can work, and that will not be online until July of 2022. Although T-Mobile just recently announced that that for their customers, anyone using 988 on T-Mobile phone will automatically be connected to the Lifeline. So some of that change is starting to happen already.
So from what I'm understanding, the infrastructure is being put together as far as the technology of getting it put through, but right now we'd still be dealing with the shortage of basically funds to man, you know, beyond a volunteer type basis, a lot of these places.
That's correct. And Headrest is a great example of that. Up until the 2019 legislative session, Headrest was funded exclusively by their own fundraising efforts, mostly in the Upper Valley where they were. So, you know, they were raising funds to and donations to support a statewide 24/7 crisis line. And we were able to, a bunch of us had been working with the legislature for a while and the Department of Health and Human Services, and we were able to get, there was not a single dollar from the state going to support Headrest crisis line before that. We were able to get $200,000 a year in the budget to support that that service. So hopefully that will continue. This is going to be a difficult budget year, as we all know, because of COVID. But, you know, we're looking at, that's just one example of across the country how the 160 different crisis centers are struggling with funding and how they will view this change with the 988 number.
That is Ken Norton. He is the executive director of NAMI New Hampshire, joining us here on Hampshire Now. A couple questions for from me. I want to talk about suicide here in a second, which I think is a really important conversation, particularly during this time period where, you know, generally the holidays and you know, seasonal depression as a result of the fact that there is no sunlight pretty much throughout the course of the day. At this point in time, you wake up, it's dark, you
get home,
still at work, and it's dark, and then you get home and it's dark. And so it's obviously, you know, a challenge. We'll talk about that in a second. But I want to get your take on what you feel. As you mentioned, the budget, obviously here in New Hampshire, but also, you know, federally, are going to be interesting to see how this works out. And Governor Sununu has talked about the fact, and Senator Bradley and Republican leadership have talked about their commitment to mental health care. And you know, Joe Biden and Jill Biden, in fact, was at Riverbend, you know, just prior to the New Hampshire primary, and talked about their commitment to mental health care. So what do you sense is the trajectory of this conversation with you know, state officials moving forward, and also now with a president-elect Biden and the commitments that he has made to this being a significant part of his administration, and also Dr. Biden's focus on this topic?
You know, I tend to be the eternal optimist around these things, and sometimes naively so. But I continue to be pretty optimistic. I mean, we came through and are still feeling the effects of a pretty dark couple of decades relative to mental health when at the turn of the century here, and then the recession that followed. But in, you know, in recent years, there's been very strong bipartisan support in the legislature and certainly with Governor Sununu to change that trajectory. So we had the 10-year mental health plan released in 2019, and there were some significant legislative changes relative to that and increases in funding. And we saw a bunch of that that's notable for children through the development of the Children's System of Care and legislation in 2017, 2019 that more firmly established that system of care for kids. And so part of that recognition was the need that we need to move further upstream, and that if we're going to get ahead of mental health issues, we need to start addressing them earlier. We know that that for many people, you know, major mental illness starts before the age of 14, and so, you know, moving things upstream, including early childhood and early infant mental health, ages 0 to 6, so some initiatives with that. So I do take the governor at his word, and certainly intend to hold him to that around mental health funding. It's been a priority of his administration since he started, and you know, and we've had some significant gains. Senator Moore, Senator Bradley have been excellent as well. Rennie Cushing, who's Representative Cushing, who will be the new minority leader, and Speaker Hinch also have, you know, have been pretty clear in their support for mental health. So at the state level, I think we're in good shape. And at the federal level, I think that there is a lot of recognition right now that, and a lot of talk, a lot of media coverage about the increases in anxiety and depression that are being reported across all age groups because of COVID. And you know, certainly significant challenges for children with being in school or not being in school and working, you know, virtually and remotely, some kids thriving, some kids not, but the lack of activities and whether it's sports or extracurricular things, as well as for all of us, whether it's graduations or funerals or weddings and not being able to gather for the holidays and connect in the way that we, you know, are used to connecting. Isolation can in its form be pretty severe and impact negatively on people's mental illness. In its most severe form, it can kill people by suicide, whether that's real isolation or perceived isolation. And so, you know, in this COVID era, that makes it even more challenging, is how do we connect and be sure that social distancing isn't becoming social isolation.
Now, Ken, when you would mention that with COVID it's turning a spotlight on how quickly someone can all of a sudden be dealing with the anxiety and depression. Do you feel that maybe this could be some type of silver lining to where people are starting to realize, well, wait a second, this isn't just something that's happening to this person over there. It's something that's happening to me, or something that's happening to the person in my house. Do you think that hopefully that this could be, like, I'm like you, I try to be the eternal optimist. Do you think that that this difficult time could all of a sudden enlighten people's thoughts on, wait, this is a serious subject that we really need to get on?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. And a couple things. I mean, one very clear silver lining that we've already seen is the use of telehealth. And, you know, for years, advocates have been trying to expand rules and payment reimbursement around telehealth, and those efforts just went on steroids when COVID hit. And, you know, and so now we're seeing a lot of different telehealth. And telehealth can mean a telephone, it can mean texting, it can mean FaceTime or Zoom or a social media platform, or there's other more private, confidential forms that some organizations use. And we're seeing, you know, and hearing that many providers are reporting much lower cancellation rates using telehealth than when they were doing things in person, because people don't have transportation or childcare or, you know, employment conflict. So that's certainly one thing. And I think, you know, one of the other things that's been really interesting is that, you know, there is that increased awareness that you describe about that this is happening to the general population. And this is coming on top of a couple of other significant awareness, if you will, events over the last couple decades. One is starting with veterans and the coverage around veterans' mental health and their higher rates of trauma and depression and suicide in the past. And more recently, similar coverage around our first responders, and knowing that first responders have higher rates of trauma and depression and suicide. And so I think that there's this recognition that if our strongest men and women are dealing with these mental health issues, that they're these are not weaknesses or, you know, or personal failings. They are true biological illnesses, and we need to provide more support for them. I think we're also seeing it, you know, across all age groups. I mean, I see it in my dad, who just turned 90. He's in an assisted living setting. He's always been an incredibly positive person, but it's taken the isolation and the, you know, the quarantine that's resulted from COVID has taken it toll on him and his mental health. And we're seeing that a lot for different seniors. And then, you know, there's just the stress of how do we navigate this? Families looking at the holidays and people within families having different beliefs about personal protection and risk relative to COVID. And, you know, should we have a visit? No, we shouldn't have a visit. Or, you know, you're not being safe or, you know, whatever. And that creates a lot of added tension to a time, period of time, which you say correctly, I mean, we're losing daylight. The holidays are always stressful in many ways for people. I mean, they're beneficial, but there's always a lot of stress as well. So I think that there is a lot of attention in being paid to mental health right now, and both COVID-related and just generally.
Well, Ken, really appreciate you joining us for the program. A tremendous conversation, and look forward to chatting again soon.
Good. Well, take care and be safe, and hope you have a great Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Ken Norton, Executive Director of NAMI New Hampshire, joining us here on the I'm Listening program presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. This is I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health and Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. I am Chris Reinwald, Paul Quittadama. We're inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. We want to remind you that this upcoming Tuesday, December the 1st, is Giving Tuesday. And, of course, we would like for you to consider giving to Riverbend, your local nonprofit community mental health center. And they would be so grateful for your support and that of the community coming up on Giving Tuesday. Again, people can give directly at the website, which is riverbendcmhc.org. Again, riverbendcmhc.org. And we encourage you to think about giving to Riverbend, who does such tremendous work throughout the community. And Ken highlighted, you know, some of that work and the focus that we have had over the last number of years in regards to having a mobile crisis unit and also providing a 24-hour service for all individuals in the community that are suffering from mental health episodes or just looking for, you know, some advice in circumstances in which they are having a mental health crisis.
Yeah, and huge, huge work also in folks dealing with substance misuse disorder. So they do so much to help our community, and we need to do everything we can to help them out so they can continue to do what really is a yeoman's job here.
Well, that is certainly well said. That is Paul Quittadama. I am Chris Ryan. This is I'm Listening, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. Again, Riverbend wants you to know the treatment works. For more information, check out riverbendcmhc.org. And again, on this Giving Tuesday, we encourage you to consider giving a donation to Riverbend, and you can do so at the website, which is riverbendcmhc.org.